Hello and welcome to another episode of Beyond Busy, the show where we talk productivity, work-life balance, and how people define happiness and success. My name is Graham Alcott. I'm your host for the show. And on this episode, I'm talking to Alex Pang. He's the author of a couple of books, one called Rest and one called Shorter. And we're going to be talking a lot about the four-day week, which feels like it's one of those ideas that has gone from fringe to a bit more mainstream, particularly in recent times. People talking about the sort of post-COVID economy and ways to rebuild and all this kind of stuff. And I'm kind of seeing a lot more coverage and credible coverage around the four-day week. It kind of feels like it's growing as an idea. And as you may or may not know, my company Think Productive, we've been doing a four-day week for about 8 years. So we talk about that a little bit in the episodes. And I think Alex is pretty surprised that he hadn't heard that we were doing that. And, you know, not deliberately, but we'd been kind of keeping a bit of a low profile with our four-day week stuff. Just we didn't really think it was that remarkable, so we weren't really telling the story. And weirdly, we'd told a couple of PR agencies and much more marketing savvy companies about it. They'd started doing four-day week and then started going, hey, we're doing a four-day week, and getting loads of coverage about it. So we talk a lot about that in this episode and how that idea might grow. And we recorded this before the lockdown. So I thought that might be quite a nice thing for this week, because we start the episode talking about the West End shows that Alex is going to see while he's over here from the States. So that's how we start the episode. And it kind of feels like a different world listening back to it now. But I hope you'll find that, you know, entertaining and kind of interesting, and kind of a little bit of escapism maybe as well. So, we're going to get straight into the episode in a second with Alex. The other thing I just want to say at the beginning is I have recently launched my new mailing list. It's called Rev Up for the Week. So every Sunday I'm releasing an email, which is just a little short blog post, short piece of writing with just a positive idea for the week, which feels very timely right now. So just positivity on a Sunday, getting you ready for the week. So if you want to sign up for that, just go to grahamalcott.com and you'll see the little box on the homepage, and in fact, at the bottom of every other page as well. So just fill in your box there. If you don't see an email back, go to your spam. It's probably there. It happens, and sign up for that. It's building really nicely, actually. And I'm loving the sort of discipline of putting something constructive and positive out there at least once a week. So it's nice to just have a rhythm around that sort of creativity for me. And the discipline of that is good. And also just the interaction of it's been really good. So just getting emails back from people saying, hey, really love this bit. What about that? I disagree with that. Just kind of little things like that have been really interesting for me, just to sort of get out of my little solitude bubble and connect often with a lot of people that I haven't connected with for a long time as well. So that's been really good. So let's get straight into the episode. So I'm in London with Alex Pang. We're going to talk about the four-day week. Alex's book, Shorter, has just come out. So let's get into it. Here we are talking West End plays and what Alex is going to do in London. So I'm here with Alex Soojung Kim Pang. How are you doing?
Great. That's good. Good to be with you.
So you've come from Silicon Valley last week.
Last week. So been over here doing press for the new book, and we'll also sneak in a couple shows. While we're in London.
What are you going to go and see?
We're going to go see Phantom, because I've never seen it. Mm. And this is now, I think, the only city in the world where one could see three different Andrew Lloyd Webber musicals on three different nights. So, you know, why not, win in Rome?
I think that's always the case with London, though, probably, right? Like, he's so prolific. Yeah.
And then a friend of my wife's actually has a play at the Globe on Wednesday. So we're going to go see that. And I know nothing about it, but I will enjoy it.
Nice.
I'm sure. And then we're going to go up to Oxford for a couple of days and then back home to do US promotion for the American edition of Shorter.
Nice.
So, yeah. Trying to keep busy.
And obviously, this is a podcast which touches a lot on work-life balance. Sounds like you have things in pretty good shape in that regard.
Well, I feel like it. I mean, you know, this is a busier week than normal, but I find, you know, one of the real revelations for me over writing the last couple books, and this is my third trade press book that's coming out, is that when I first started writing this way, after, you know, having a earlier career as an academic, I didn't really think of the book promotion as kind of an extension of the work of being an author. You know, it was just this kind of onerous thing that you had to do, you know, for the man.
Yeah.
But it actually turns out that, especially if you get people who, you know, have read the book, you know, work in a similar area, and, you know, you can actually have conversations that don't just require you to, like, rehash the book, but actually get you thinking about new subjects, or how what you've written maybe applies in areas that you haven't really thought about. And in fact, Shorter itself grew out of conversations that I had while promoting Rest. And so I think that as a result, you know, for me, it is valuable to treat these things as kind of a serious intellectual enterprise. And that means that while I'm doing this, it's also important to kind of build in some downtime.
Yeah.
You know, because you need time for ideas to settle, to process things, to reflect. Kind of, if you're doing a kind of work where you're just doing the same thing over and over again, and you don't really have to kind of learn from your experience, maybe you don't need that sort of opportunity for reflection. But when you're doing stuff where you actually can learn some new things about what you're doing,
yeah,
you don't want to lose those moments and those opportunities. And if there's one really significant thing I've learned from writing Rest, it was that you really gotta be conscious about building in those times, especially in today's working world. And so, you know, for me here, what that means is having a ton of stuff during the day, but also making sure that I've got, you know, time in the evenings to do stuff like go out on long walks.
Yeah, right? For sure.
You know, sort of sit someplace, write about the day, think stuff through, and, you know, make sure that that stuff is, you know, captured and has time to kind of settle into a form that I can build on.
For sure. And it's like, I mean, you've talked about this in both the books we just talked about there, Rest, and both in Rest and Shorter, but this idea that if you're working with ideas and problem solving and creativity, that actually the work continues even when you stop working, right? So that downtime is actually often where people get their best ideas from, or where you suddenly have this eureka moment or something pops into your head, because the brain just, you know, keeps on working away at those ideas or those problems or whatever,
right,
like, as you develop, right? So like, that feels to me like a really important thing. So we talked about Rest there, which essentially is a book about how if you work less, then you get more done. And then Shorter, you're focusing much more on individual case studies of companies and sort of different ways that people have taken the idea of work less and then get more done, and created for the founders and for the people in that business better work-life balance, more sustainable cultures,
right,
and everything else.
Yeah.
So I mean, this is obvious to me because my company's been doing a four-day week for a long time. But should we just start at the beginning? So it feels to me like a very strange, counterintuitive idea. It certainly is when I try and explain it to other people, that you can get more done in 4 days than you would in five, and so on and so forth. So should we just start with what you see as the main benefits of a four-day working week or a shorter working week?
Sure. So I have looked at companies around the world, here in the UK, Scandinavia, the US, Australia, New Zealand. Interestingly, Japan and Korea have a lot of them. And these are, you know, two countries whose languages have their own words for working yourself to death.
Yeah, right.
So it is, what I'm seeing is that it's a global movement. It's also one that, you know, ranges across creative industries, you know, professional service firms, financial advisories, but also nursing homes, factories, restaurants yeah. which of yeah. course, you know, talk about an industry where overwork is the norm. Yeah.
My girlfriend's a chef, by the way.
Okay.
And I was talking to her about when we'd set this up.
Mm-hmm.
I said, hey, you know, I'm going to have this podcast 4 day week. And her instant reaction was, this would never work in my industry. And I opened the book to read it, and the first case study is a restaurant in Edinburgh. You know?
Right.
It is one of those things that, again, you start to think about this could be possible in certain industries, but not others. But yeah. what you're finding is very different.
It is, you know, it requires work to figure out how to make it work in every industry. And the solutions are, of course, different depending upon, you know, sort of the kind of work you do and the expectations of your clients and the particular economics of your industry. But, you know, fundamentally, I think there are a couple places that these companies start from. You know, first off, they are all run by founders or CEOs who've had their own experiences with overwork, you know, with burnout or a health crisis that signals that they need to make a change, or, you know, 2 years from now, they're not going to be in this job. And if you're, you know, if you're the CEO of a startup or you're, you know, the chef owner of a restaurant, you need to fix this if the company is going to survive.
Yeah.
Stay open. For all of them also, recruitment and retention is also a big thing, right? You know, sort of there's a war for talent in the software industry. In restaurants, there is huge turnover and, you know, challenges keeping talented people in the industry in the face of incredibly long hours in a high pressure environment.
Yeah.
And so that's another thing that that companies are trying to solve for. And then, you know, things like better work-life balance, opportunities for professional development or creative renewal. Being able to do a job well is important, but there's no industry in which having new ideas is an insignificant thing, right? I think, you know, we often don't think of stuff, you know, places like nursing homes, let's say, as kind of, they're not creative industries, sort of in the, you know, in the same way that, it, you know, a design firm is, but that work does require an ability to solve problems every single day.
Yeah.
You know, and so even if you are, you know, work, you know, if you're a nurse's aide, you need to be able to access some of the opportunities for rest and renewal that, you know, a composer or a chef needs.
Mm.
And then, that's kind of why companies do it. And then what I'm seeing in at least the office context is everyone doing a few basic things, right? All, you know, they all shorten meetings dramatically. Meetings default to an hour long because sometime in the 1980s, an anonymous programmer in Redmond, Washington, decided that in calendaring programs, the default was an hour.
Yeah.
Nobody hit, and, you know, the rest of the world just seemed to accept that this was how long meetings should be.
I went with loads of people, by the way, who don't know that you can actually just type over that and just say it's going to be 46 right. minutes. They think that they have to work in a 15-minute or a 30-minute or an hour-long chunk of time. Right?
And it turns out that if you've got, say, a calendaring program and another program for reserving offices, that often it's difficult to change the defaults in one and have them carry over into the other.
Yeah.
So it turns out there are these like weird technical things that that can get in the way of changing meeting lengths and kind of making it stick across an organization. But, you know, fundamentally, I think that, most of these places shorten, you know, they will get rid of, you know, the weekly update meeting or other standing meetings, or make them dramatically shorter. They will impose meeting discipline, you know, thinking more about who needs to be in the room, you know, circulating agendas beforehand, having particular thing, you know, action items for that time, and being really kind of ruthless about actually creating value in that time. That's an early win because nobody really loves meetings. everybody knows that you could do them better. And so so solving this problem that is almost universal is a way of building a degree of confidence that, yes, you can actually make substantive changes in the way, in the way people work. It obviously clears up more time in everyone's schedule. And it raises the question, if you are able to change this basic thing that people have dealt with for years, what else can you change?
It
sort of opens up a space for rethinking other parts of the day.
And then, it is almost like a sort of, I'm gonna swear.
That's fine.
Because it's my
podcast. It's your podcast.
Yeah, so warning. But it's a bit of a head fuck, right? Mm-hmm. It's a bit of a mind fuck in the sense that people are so used to this 5-day, 9-to-5 rhythm that like throwing people off that rhythm, I think we're just creatures of habit, aren't we? And it's really difficult. So yeah, it opens up that innovation around doing other things too. Yeah.
So, that's an important early thing. And then, the couple other things that everyone does is you look for ways to reduce technology-driven distractions or other kinds of distractions.
Yeah.
So, that means things like having particular times of day when you check your email and having permission, importantly, to ignore it the rest of the day.
Yeah.
Getting Slack under control if you're in an office where people generally have 12 tabs open. And then the other big thing is kind of redesigning the daily schedule so that there are particular blocks of time, often in the morning, where people have permission to be a little antisocial, to work on their hardest problems without any interruptions, because, and this works because very often, a couple hours of focused, concentrated work, you can get more done than in a distracted 8-hour day.
Absolutely.
And,
so in my book, I call that proactive attention. And then Cal Newport called it deep work, which is just way better. Well done, Cal.
but implementing that for everybody,
as opposed
to making it something that you've got to kind of carve out of your day, is, I think, a really valuable thing. And making it a social norm, making it something that everybody can do, is also a really, really useful discipline because, among other things, it just reduces the worry that you might have that you're seen as not a good team player. It also makes clearer to, it kind of turns attention into a social resource. And in fact, there's this important kind of social dimension to attention and focus.
Yeah. Right?
Your ability to concentrate depends on my willingness to not interrupt you, to respect the fact that you've got stuff you need to get done just as I do. And that if we all cooperate on that, then we can get out of here at the end of the day Thursday and be done for the week.
Yeah.
So, just those three things, dealing with meetings, dealing with tech distractions, redesigning the day, is enough in most places to allow, it goes a long way to letting you do 5 days work in 4, and then you get into various particular things that companies do depending upon what industry they're in and what opportunities there are for automating some kinds of routine work and augmenting your ability to do, higher value added work. And sometimes simply eliminating some jobs that are kind of legacy and traditional, but which are no longer really valuable either to you or to your clients.
Yeah, I guess like the universal truths. People always think that, I'm overworked, I've got loads to do, I need the number of hours that I've got in the day. That's like a really universal reaction to this stuff. But also what's, I think, pretty universally true is that if people are really honest with themselves, there are always a few hours in the week. We all do it. There's hours where we're not using those hours as optimally as we could do. And one of my experiences with, being around the idea of the 4-day week or 5-hour working days and some of those experiments and stuff is that, if you've only got 5 hours, you treat that 5 hours so preciously compared to 7 or 8 hours, right? Because it's like, this is such a precious resource. And people are much more heads down and focused because they know they're leaving in the middle of the afternoon and going to have a have a nice time later on, right? So like it kind of shifts that dynamic. And I think for me, you know, everybody really craves, when I go and do workshops and talks to people, everyone's really craving more thinking space and sort of time to actually get the, you know, the real big priority work done and not be in that reactive mode, right? So like, so presumably you're seeing that this is something that actually creates a different culture in organizations as well as just being a short number of hours.
Absolutely. You know, I've had leaders say, you know, and, you know, these are people who did their share of, you know, 12-hour days or, you know, sleeping under their desks right before, you know, big projects were done, that, you know, anybody can sit in a chair for 12 hours, right? Anybody can get a task done with enough time, right? What really impresses me now is the person who can plan out the work and get it done in 6 hours rather than 12. And I think that, you know, that by... one of the things that the shorter day does is get organizations and teams to look at their processes, to think about where the inefficiencies are, you know, what stuff can be automated. And that in turn changes the way that they think about and value time, right? If, you know, if they set an organizational goal of being able to, you know, do all the work in 6 hours rather than 10 or 4 days rather than, you know, 5 or 6, then time becomes a more valuable resource. And you think about, you know, you take more seriously the challenge of how you can be more effective and more efficient rather than assuming that, you know, the process is what it is and people will just stay late and, you know, kind of make up for inefficiencies in the system or problems with the schedule and so on. It tends to get people to think more about systemic and organizational solutions to those problems because they value their time, because they value their time.
Yeah.
Full stop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to come back to that idea and the flip side of that, which is organizations that charge their services out by the hour. So let's park that for a second.
Sure.
But just let's finish off on the benefits part of it. One of the things that I really liked was, I can't remember who it was in the book, but someone in the book said there's fewer, I never heard this phrase before, but fewer spin up and spin down times. So this idea that, you know, you travel to work, you get there, you have coffee, you socialize a little bit, you know, you check in, you boot the laptop up, all that sort of stuff has to happen.
Right.
So just having fewer of those times in the week just means that on a sort of percentage basis, just, you know, by just the way that works, you get more of your time is going to be in a more productive mode, right? So like that kind of feels like a good, almost like a sort of offshoot benefit or a sort of additional benefit, right?
Yeah, you know, and I think you can see this most dramatically in like factory work, right? It takes a certain amount of time to warm up machines and they need time to cool down at the end of the day.
Yeah, yeah.
But there is a similar kind of thing with, you know, with people as well. And it is easy to discount the amount of time that we spend commuting, doing all the stuff that we need to do to kind of set up for the day. But that is a non-trivial amount of time each day. Yeah. And over the course of a year, that actually does add up to something.
Compound that by 200 employees.
Exactly.
In a few years. Now,
and yeah. And all of a sudden you're talking about some real time.
Yeah, absolutely.
So one of the benefits is the time savings, shorter commuting times, you know, less energy and money spent, you know, just getting to and from work. There is plenty of people who are, you know, parents of young children talk about there being, you know, substantial money savings when you've got a kid in childcare 4 days rather than five.
Yeah.
And then places that survey this, you know, using Office Vibe or Net Promoter Score or other kinds of measures, find that people report being happier both at work and out of work, you know, and at home. They talk about having better work-life balance. And these things are pretty, these are things that you would expect when you go to 4 days.
Yeah.
But people also are healthier because you've got more time to cook decent food to exercise. And interestingly, to get back to the question of time pressure, there was a place, a medical documentation company called Synergy Vision in London that did surveys of people right before starting a four-day week and 6 months after. And one of the numbers that went up was the number of people who said that they felt they had enough time in the day to get their work done. That went from about 50% right. to almost 80%.
Wow.
Even when going from 5 days yeah. to four, you know, by eliminating all of those inefficiencies, mm. cutting the meetings and all that other stuff, created, even though absolutely, you know, everyone knew there were fewer hours in the week to work, the subjective sense was that they now had more time to actually get the work done.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, it's both pretty remarkable, but I think a lot of us have had experiences of working in offices where if you kind of reflect for 10 seconds on your own experience, you think, yeah, I can see how that would be, how that would be true.
Yeah. I mean, the other benefit I really liked, you talked about this company called Taipei Media.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I found this with Think Productive with my company as well, that what happens is you've got, as a small company, the pressure of trying to compete with, you know, much bigger organizations on wages, you just can't do it.
Right.
So if you're in a place where people are looking for something different and you're able to offer that, then mm-hmm. you can actually be, you know, hyper competitive in terms of culture and satisfaction and everything else. Mm-hmm. And people are willing to, you know, to take that little pay cut to come to an organization that will, you know, really serve their interests. And I love the person from Taipei Media who said, their ideal hire is someone who has an expense account, but they're treated like shit.
Yeah.
And so it's like, you know, like those people are willing to move from those kind of organizations in order to kind of have that kind of better work-life balance and kind of better lifestyle.
No, Ross is who's the founder of Taipei Media was very colorful on all of these issues. But, you know, it is the case that, you know, for small companies, hiring and retention is like an existential thing, right? You can't lose a key developer at a bad moment, and you know, and one bad hire in a company of 10 people can be really toxic. And what all of these companies report is that when you can offer a 4-day week, you're not offering such gigantic salaries, but it attracts the attention often of people who are a little more senior, you know, people who have, you know, sort of done their share of late nights. Maybe they've got young kids. They're far enough in their profession to think that, you know, the long hours were cool when I was younger, but it's kind of stupid to keep working this way. And they can see how you could make work better. And they value their time a lot more. And so for them, the proposition of, you know, of not just having more time for their families and themselves, but having the interesting challenge of figuring out how I can redesign my work, you know, is something that can be really, really appealing.
Mm.
And I think especially for I hear this a little bit more with companies that are, let's say, outside London or, you know, not in Sydney or Melbourne, but in, you know, Hobart, Tasmania. They're able to attract people who otherwise might not be that interested in relocating. Or in some cases, you've got kind of talent that has already started, you know, moving in this direction anyway. You know, looking for better work-life balance, but they've got a two-hour commute now, and if they can cut that down to 10 minutes and work 4 days a week, then that, you know, that's fantastic.
I mean, that's dramatic, isn't it? If you think, you know, 2 hours commute each way, you know, take a day off that as well. Like, that's a dramatic change in lifestyle.
It is. And, you know, we often commute at the times of day when our minds are at their best.
Mm.
You know, there are lots of us who in, you know, like between 8 and 12 are at our cognitive peaks. And, you know, we're spending a good chunk of that, you know, that cognitive energy dealing with traffic.
Yeah.
which is,
or reading really bad newspapers if you live in London.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and it's a real loss.
Yeah.
And so being able to take that really high quality time and to actually devote it to work is, I think, a double win.
Yeah, so let's talk about some of the resistance to this whole idea then. Mm-hmm. So I'd love to hear what you know about the Wellcome Trust. And they're probably the biggest, most high-profile organization in the UK that have flirted with this idea and then decided against it.
Right.
Maybe this is a time to talk about the Wellcome Trust, or maybe there's a bigger point to be made first. But it feels to me like there's often a lot of skepticism. And you talk in the book about a couple of examples where the boss has said to, you know, the owner of the company or whatever has said to the team, hey, we're going to move to this four-day week. And it is expecting a fanfare of joy and celebration and champagne. And actually everyone's going, what? No way. We couldn't do this. And there's this kind of skepticism and cynicism that builds very quickly. So, so let's start with, why do you think that's the case? Why do you think people are so reluctant to engage in that sort of head fuck change thing?
I think that there's, partly because people are exposed to enough change initiatives that don't go anywhere. Partly people who want to do a good job look at a dramatic change like that, you know, and the first question is, how am I going to get all my work done in time?
Yeah.
Right? I don't feel like I have enough time in 5 days to do this.
Yeah.
And now, you know, now we're going to say four. The other question, the other big question is, what happens to salaries? Right? Does this mean you're going to cut my salary 20% and expect me to do the same work? Now, the answer to that last one is no. Salaries in these companies stay the same, and so in a sense, effectively, people kind of get a raise. You also, you know, indirectly through lower commuting costs, childcare, that's a bit more of a bump. But I think that the best version of the skepticism is people who want to do a good job and want the time to do a good job want to make sure that this isn't going to make that difficult. So that's, I think, the first place that it comes from. And then, you know, they're just the ordinary logistical questions of how in the world do you make this work? Especially in an era where our solution to the problem of having too much to do is to work longer. Proposing that you go in a different direction requires some explanation.
That's where
the internal resistance comes from. You know, resistance externally has different sources, but in important ways, interestingly, is less of an obstacle than most places expect. And I think that was one of the most surprising things I found when researching the book.
Yeah.
So, because the question of how are clients going to react is always a big thing. And the worry, of course, is that clients are going to hate this. They're going to desert you. You're going to go out of business. And I have heard one story of one prospective client who said, no, I need your people to sleep with their phones under their pillows. I haven't heard any stories of clients, of existing clients, ending their contracts.
Actually leaving,
And in fact, they've been quite supportive. And
but what happens if, you know, in agencies where you're charging people out by the day, right? And you've got a certain level of retainer. So what happens there? Because then you're presumably, if you're the founder of that agency, going to your clients and you're saying, hey, you know, we're taking this much as a retainer every month. Well, that used to get you 5 days. Now it gets you four. But trust us, it'll be more productive. And that's quite a difficult sell, right?
Yeah. So if you are, if your current model is essentially to charge by the hour or the day, you got to switch to a project-based billing model instead.
Right.
So the accounting firms and financial service advisories that have done this have made that move first. I do know of a couple small law firms that have done it, explicitly as part of an effort to just do less work. And so they did not play around with their billing. They just reduced the number of clients that they were sort of that they took on.
So to do less work, as in let's make this more sustainable and we'll make a bit less profit, but that's fine
because
we're in this for the long haul.
Right. Yeah. But I don't have notable examples of places where they said, effectively, our hourly rates are going to go up by 25%, but you're going to get the same quality of work out of us. Mm. I think psychologically, it's easier for clients to get their heads around the idea that the project delivery dates are going to stay the same. You're paying the same amount of money for the same work. And it's just, you know, internal housekeeping and whatever the company needs to do in order to get this stuff done is up to them.
Yeah.
When you're paying people by the hour, I think there is this sense you have, you know, you have more command over their time. And so you are challenged, I think, to figure out how you can make this work if you stick to an hourly billing model.
Mm. And what's just occurred to me as well, is it, you know, because there's like these agencies that end up putting cameras in their office so that client, you know, promising clients can check in on where their people are all the time because you're paying their wages and all this kind of thing. Feels like this is the opposite end of the spectrum when it comes to trust and autonomy to, let's say, the sort of Jeff Bezos, Amazon warehouse, you know, kind of Taylorism thing of everything's micromanaged and time is, you know, you have KPIs around how many books you can put on the, you know, in boxes per 3 seconds and all that sort of thing, right?
Right.
Like it's a very different, they're almost like two competing philosophies that are, you know, probably going to shape the next 20, 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think that there are things that companies will do in order to help reassure clients that they'll be accessible when need be.
Mm.
And for example, there's one, you know, one firm has now started having project email addresses. And so a client can write to that, you know, write to that address and guarantees that, you know, there's always someone who's watching that inbox. And so even on, you know, Fridays or if there's an emergency on weekends, there'll be someone who will respond. And then another important thing that that companies who are able to do this will do is automate some of the processes so that clients have easier access to kinds of reports that used to be generated by humans.
Right.
So I'm thinking in particular of a cloud-based accounting firm called Farnell Clark up in Norwich. And, you know, traditional accounting is done, you know, was even today in some places, you've still got like the ledger books and people writing stuff down and all that. And doing like quarterly reports, generating those things is a whole bunch of work that someone's got to go through.
Yeah.
With cloud-based accounting, you know, you get your clients to use, there are various tools that they use for, you know, for submitting receipts and all that stuff. A lot of that work is automated, which also means that stuff like quarterly reports can be set up to be generated automatically.
Yeah.
You know, or if a client has a question about some set of expenses or, you know, can I do this thing? Can we invest in this? You can answer that much more quickly. What that also means for Farnell Clark is that they've been able to move from just doing like accounting and taxes to doing more financial advisory stuff,
right?
Which is, of course, you know, which of course you can charge more for, but which also requires a higher level of understanding of your clients and a greater degree of trust on their part that, you know, you understand them and you have advice worth taking. And then I think that there, you know, and then the, you know, other places will have individuals who are tasked with, you know, watching the company inbox, or of on Fridays or on weekends, just in case. But I think what a lot of them find is that there are fewer emergencies than you expect. Right. I think the attitude that you always need to be responsive to clients comes from a good place.
Yeah.
But it can contribute to the sense that because there might be something happening. You always have to, you know, you've always got to man it, watch the inbox. And that turns out not so much to really be the case in a lot of businesses. Certainly there are ones, you know, where there are genuine surprises.
Mm.
But lots of places find that that's more manageable than they expect. And I think in some cases, interestingly, clients don't mind having a little extra time when they don't have to respond to you. Yeah. Clients themselves are time stressed themselves.
That's very true. Yeah.
And so in a sense, there is a little bit of a gift in not putting them in a position where they feel like they have to check in on you on Fridays or email in the evenings.
Yeah. It's the same reason I love a bank holiday. I love working a bank holiday Monday and then I'll take the Thursday or the Friday off. Because it's like, if you zig while everyone else zags,
right,
you just know that you don't have like 100 people sort of coming back to you.
Yeah.
So we've got a few minutes left. And I think what would be nice to talk about is there must be loads of people who are sat there listening to this going, this sounds like it could be the future. This sounds great. But I'm stuck in the middle of a big organization that is just never going to change or is going to be behind the curve or whatever. So what thoughts do you have around that? So people who, they're working 5 days a week, but are there lessons that they can take from a 4-day week or different kinds of work patterns, even within a 5-day structure?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, first off, that making this kind of change work in big organizations definitely is harder. The more number of moving parts you have, the larger the number of people who have to say yes, let's try this, or gets in the way of those changes. But I think that even if you're in of a bigger organization, that first off, there is the chance in smaller units to experiment with this on your own. Right. SK, the Korean Chaebol that does telecom stuff, and they're a cell phone company and a bunch of other things. They've got a couple smaller units right now that are trialing 4-day weeks or like 9 days in 2 weeks kinds of things, with the idea that what they learn in these smaller units can eventually be rolled out elsewhere. And in fact, Ford Motor Company, you know, famously moved the assembly line to a 5-day week in 1926. They'd spent 3 years getting to 5 days in all the rest of the company. They knew an awful lot about how to make this work when they finally put it into the biggest, most important part of the company. So I think that, you know, that structuring these more local experiments is one possibility if you can, you know, if either you're a manager who can do this with your own reports, or if you have a manager who you can convince.
Yeah.
If you're not in either of those positions, I think there are still things you can learn from these small companies about how to more effectively use your time, about the kind of social nature of time and attention that can help you and your colleagues be more effective. And then at least, you know, if you can't sneak out the door on Thursday, free up time for more professional development stuff, example. And, you know, there are companies who operate on a model where they work 4 days and then the fifth day, the office is open. So people can come in and kind of tinker around with programming languages or their own projects. So
it's like free Fridays,
exactly,
right? So it's like, it's still open, come in and do professional development.
Right. This is popular, especially with like software companies.
Yeah.
Because for one thing, Google had 20% time, which was always something you had to negotiate it as an individual. It was never a company-wide thing, but it was always seen as something incredibly valuable if you could negotiate it. If you're in a profession that is changing and it's worth learning new things, you might be able to use the time that way. And then I think at the very worst, there is satisfaction in being able to do things like, you know, your work more effectively and run meetings more efficiently. That's good for building up local social capital, even if it doesn't immediately translate into into a shorter work week for everybody. But even since I turned in the manuscript a few months ago, I wrote about 100 100-odd companies in Shorter. I found another 50 that have started trials in the last several months, you know, including the Japanese office of Microsoft, which is, you know, 24, you know, more than 2,000 people right there. And so I think that the, you know, places the size of Welcome are playing around with this. And
what was the deal with Welcome? What do you know about what happened there?
Yeah, I know what I know what everybody else who read the press about it, right, which is that the sense was that it wasn't clear how you can make it work across the entire entire unit of several hundred people. And I think that there was also some, they couldn't sell it to the board, right? And for those two reasons, they decided to sort of park the idea. Mm. I think if you went back now with more companies that have done it, you could make a stronger argument.
Yeah.
And, you know, fundamentally, I think for skeptical boards, you know, the argument is, you know, the companies who've done this are more productive, they're more profitable, they've got better work-life balance, and people have more time for talent development. You know, which one of these don't you like?
Yeah, I mean, it's like if you could take a pill that gave you all those things, you'd take it, whatever the consequence, right? Like,
you know,
and also, when you've got like, you know, Microsoft in Japan.
Right.
I mean, Microsoft, about the most corporate brand that a brand could be. Mm-hmm. Japan, about the most obsessed with, you know, overwork as a culture that we could be. And if, you know, if they're embracing that and experimenting with that, then that tells you something, right?
Now, and they saw, you know, a 40% increase in productivity measured by, you know, essentially sales dollars per, like, hour of work. Mm. But they saved a whole bunch of money on, you know, electricity costs.
Yeah.
And they printed a lot less because, you know, not just because they were working 4 days and so you took, you know, like all those numbers and you multiply by 0.8, right? It's also that the other stuff that they did in order to assure that people were able to get their work done meant not a 20% savings in, you know, paper, in, you know, in printing, but like a 40% savings.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, the story, and I see over and over again these kinds of stories of savings or productivity gains in excess of the 20% that you need in order to make this work.
Yeah,
you know, once people start looking for ways to do their jobs better so that they can leave earlier, they tend to keep doing it.
Yeah, because then you're in that mindset of sort of always looking for those improvement opportunities.
Exactly.
Right? And, then, and then good things happen.
Yeah, one of the people I interviewed said that you know, my employees now act like they own the company. All I did was give them a day off.
Yeah, right.
You can't pay people enough to behave that way.
But you can
incentivize it by giving them a day off.
Yeah. And we have a very similar mindset with Think Productive, where the four-day week is part of that, but there's just a more general sense of, you know, let's give people real ownership over the decisions, mm-hmm. and let's be transparent with what we're trying to do. And, you know, and all of that leads, I think, to a place where people feel like, yeah, they're thinking on our behalf as a company rather than just like their behalf as an employee almost.
Right. Now, I think, you know, companies definitely need to have a tolerance for risk and a willingness to let people experiment and iterate.
Yeah.
But if you can do that, then you do end up giving people a lot more ownership over their work, or, you know, in the Marxist parlance, control over their own means of production. And
I love how you start the book, by the way, with Karl Marx and Adam Smith on the same page.
Yeah,
I mean, those are your two first quotes.
Yeah, the fact that both of them saw this as worthwhile should tell you, especially I think after the most recent election, where, you know, the 4-day week was part of the labor platform and was, you know, slammed as, you know, another example of, you know, John McDonnell's secret plan to destroy the economy.
Yeah,
this really shouldn't be seen as a right-wing or a left-wing idea, but as a good piece of business strategy, as simply a good business idea. Yeah.
Absolutely. And so just before we finish, I just want to talk about you and your relationship with all this. So with me, productivity almost becomes like a rod for my own back, right? So every email I send, everyone's looking for how productive my email is. And like, you know, if I'm 3 minutes late somewhere, that's a problem. And, you know, like productivity and productivity ninja becomes a rod for my own back. So if you find yourself sort of trying to do a sneaky email on a Friday, for example, mm-hmm. like do people call you out on that? Like is working a 4-day week now something that you stick to religiously? Are there times where that doesn't quite work? How does that work with like your own personal?
Right. I actually still do the stuff that I talk about in my last book, Rest.
Yeah.
So, you know, in there I talk about the incredible power of, you know, working a concentrated 4 or 5 hour day.
Mm.
And I tend to do 4 days, like 5 or 6 days a week. Partly because I have a lot of clients who are either in Asia or in Europe.
So you do 4 hours, 5 or 6 days a week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, with time zone shifts and stuff, there's a certain amount of having to break up the day or, you know, do some stuff Sunday evening
kind of thing.
But, you know, I find even with between writing and talking to people and consulting and stuff that for me, that is that a schedule that is both effective and restorative, you know, and gives me time to both get done obvious work, but also, you know, enough time to think about non-obvious things that later become, you know, things I can talk to other people about.
And here's one of my weaknesses is that I have sort of, you know, very set schedule around how I manage my attention along similar lines, but mm-hmm. then it goes out the window when I travel, as you're traveling now, right? Mm-hmm. So how do you try and keep those things in play when you're sort of, you know, at the behest of someone else's schedule and in a different country and all that?
The first thing I do is when I'm traveling, you know, doing workshops, talks, etc., I do as much of the prep beforehand as I absolutely possibly can. I used to be one of those people who would write the talk on the plane.
Yeah.
You know, and I thought, you know, sort of, you've got 10 hours, that's plenty of time to knock it out.
I've definitely done that.
You know, and you can write a talk on the plane.
Yeah.
I find, though, that it is much better to, you know, just as you should pack carefully so that you've got everything you need, but not too much stuff.
Mm.
So too, I find that doing more planning on talks and workshops and so on, so that there's less improvisation of that around that kind of stuff, leaves more space for the kind of valuable reflection of what's happened, you know, what's happened on site, what's happening in the moment. And so essentially overplan so that you can generate more ease while you're on the road.
Yeah. I mean, that's just a brilliant productivity lesson in general. Overplan so you can generate ease just wherever. It's just a, you know.
Words to live by.
Feels like a really good place to finish. So the book's called Shorter. Do you want to just tell people where they can find you, where they can connect with you and all that kind of thing?
So on Twitter and Instagram and pretty much everything else, I'm AskPang, A-S-K-P-A-N-G. Twitter is more work stuff. Instagram is more pictures of my dogs, and, you know, coffee cups. But, you know, both have their place. And then my company is called Strategy and Rest, and the URL for that is strategy.rest. Rest is now a top level domain, which I think says something. Maybe says something positive about the future of work.
Yeah.
So.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, it's been great having you here. Enjoy London.
And always.
Thanks for being on Beyond Busy.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. So.
So thanks again to Alex for being on the show. And also thanks to Leo and Matt from Penguin for helping me to sort that one out. I want to say two more things before we go. Obviously, thanks to Mark Stedman, my producer on the show as well. And the final thing I just want to say really quickly is just in relation to Black Lives Matter and George Floyd and everything that's been happening over the last week or so. Obviously, it's been a really, you know, just a really traumatic time and not the first time, right? So this is just one of those things that it's shocking and it's also just not surprising. We had quite a few conversations internally within the team about different things that we could do, challenging our own biases, lots of stuff, which I think is really positive. And it sort of echoed what I put on Instagram last Tuesday, which was like this Blackout Tuesday thing. And I put the tile up, my black tile. And then I just felt really uneasy about it. And I wrote underneath, let's remember that our job is not to put up a black tile for today, but it's to spend a lifetime questioning our own biases, challenging prejudice, and seeking equality for every single human being. And I feel like I have a good awareness of race, and I have a mixed race son. Like, I care quite deeply about the kind of world that he is going to inhabit and how much prejudice he might face, and obviously saw some of that when I was with his mum. But you know, when I looked through the back catalogue of Beyond Busy episodes, I was really surprised at how few black faces there were. And I think I'm pretty, conscious and aware and very forward thinking around diversity. I think if you look at, 10, 12 episodes of Beyond Busy, there's probably 5 or 6 men and 5 or 6 women. You know, I'm pretty good on gender diversity. I thought I was pretty good too on racial diversity. And actually, when I looked at it, blimey, it was very white. So I just want to say at the end here, this is just a little plea, just a kind of recognition that I haven't done enough on that. And just a plea that if you know of interesting voices that you think I should elevate on this platform, particularly black voices, then please let me know, because I really want to do more and I want to do better and get some of those things out there. So I'm going to talk to a couple of people over the next week or so about this as well. But just if you have anyone in mind who you think has really interesting thoughts to share around all our usual core themes, success and productivity and work-life balance and all that stuff, then please do let me know. So I'm really just looking to do as much as I can to use this platform and give this platform over to as many black and Asian and other minority ethnic voices as I possibly can. So you can email me graham@thinkproductive.co.uk. Love to take your recommendations that way. And likewise, if you just go to grahamalcott.com, there's a contact form on there. You can just drop me a little line that way if that is easier. I want to do more. And I feel like, let's all figure out actions that we can take, and let's all spend some time, reading and thinking and challenging some of these more systemic biases. Like, it's not enough to just say, I'm going to call out racism if I see it. It's, racism is part of it, but actually the whole infrastructure is biased, and the whole infrastructure needs to change. And that takes time. And the first step of that is the awareness. So, there's loads of reading lists doing the round. I'm not going to recommend particular books, but there's a load of reading lists, doing the rounds about particular books that you can read on this subject. There's some great stuff on Netflix. There's various other things to take into account here, but like, let's do the work. Let's do some of that work and have some more of those conversations, as uneasy and as uncomfortable as they can sometimes be. It's like, I often talk about how I'm a feminist, and sometimes people find that odd. Why is a man a feminist? It's like, well, if anything, it should be more on men to solve issues of gender bias, because we're the privileged ones, right? Like, we've got more of that, perspective of privilege to be able to break it down. And so the same is true when it comes to race. And I've always thought about myself as being an anti-racist. But I do think that needs to be a proactive stance and not just a badge or a label that we call ourselves. So anyway, that's what I'm going to say on that. There's a lot more been said. And I think the key thing over the next few weeks and months is to figure out what we can do. And one of the things I can do is use this platform to elevate more black voices. So I'm going to do that. My phone's going, which means I need to sign off. So I'm going to head from here, but we'll be back in 2 weeks' time with another episode. So until then, take care. Bye for now.